You are tuned in to The Watchman, Cedric Muhammad, on the Black Coffee Channel.
Once you've gotten the yoke of the oppressor physically out of your country, they still control you with strings attached, and through the internal weaknesses and shortcomings and mistakes and errors and flaws, we keep it going voluntarily. Go tell somebody. We'll be right back.
Sobering, stimulating, and hot. It's the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee Program.
These are not just academic exercises. We're not analyzing the media on Mars or in the 18th century or something like that. We're dealing with real human beings who are suffering and dying and being tortured and starving because of policies that we are involved in. We, as citizens of democratic societies, are directly involved in and are responsible for. And what the media are doing is ensuring that we do not act on our responsibilities and that the interests of power are served, not the needs of the suffering people, and not even the needs of the American people, who would be horrified if they realized the blood that's dripping from their hands because of the way they're allowing themselves to be deluded and manipulated by the system.
Muhammad. Cedric Muhammad.
Yo, take a second. What if we could rewind the hood? Better yet, what if the locks would have signed with Suge? What if Puffy never signed us? What if Oprah made them comments like I must? What if you designed this, thought like I did, said it like this? What if Peyton was fighting dogs instead of Mike Vick? What if Arnold would have just let Tookie get life? What if Big missed the party? What if Pac missed the fight? What if you was caged in? What would you change then? What if there was no
federal
law for made men? What if hate ran through me? And what if Portland would have drafted Jordan instead of Sam Bowie? What if you really had to be nice to get a deal? What if all of these rappers, Ice was really real? What if I hit you with the razor and keep the chin? What if Mike Jackson never would have bleached his skin? What if you had to know things that you needed to know? What if you never been places you needed to go? What if you get there and learn them as you go? What if is the question, can I ask you once more? What if you never knew things that you needed to know? What if you never been places you needed to go? What if you get there and learn them as you go? What if is the question, can I ask you once more? What if the pain went away? What if you changed in a day? What if you could eliminate all the games we can play? What if Shine beat the case? What if Diddy did a dime flat? What if Nelson Mandela could give his time back? What if Malcolm was silent? What if Martin was violent? What if you could really sneak a Uzi on an island? What if I make you kiss the Nina? What if a brick was only just a misdemeanor? What if Manhattan was hit by Hurricane Katrina? What if a black man was the one controlling FEMA? What if we ain't never let emotions come between us? What if the last time we rode, somebody seen us? What if new things that you needed to know? What if you never been places you needed to go? What if you get there and learn them? What if is the question, can I ask them once more? What if you never knew things that you needed to know? What if you never been places you needed to go? What if you get there and learn them as you go? What if is the question, can I ask them once more?
Yo, I flow calm but don't push. What if Saddam hung Bush? What if one mic was called one hook? What if the bridge never showed me how to hold a weapon? What if I ran up in that shit chick with no protection? What if I never wore that army jacket? Car hard to match it, unlaced Timbs. The hood on my first album cover under plastic. What if I was another corny rapper? What if I went instead of Notorious? Who would tell my story after? What if I loved less and lust more? If Obama was on Rushmore, would I be entitled?
lights in the bus door.
Shut
if I never cleared out that private window, would never been scared for the life of me and my kinfolk. What if that gun been broke? I would have never leaned back in the end zone, all red. What if real niggas was all dead? What if Hillary and them was reptilian? In 2012 was the end of men and all world civilians.
What if you never knew things that you needed to know? What if you never been places you needed to go? What if you get there and learn them as you go? What if, is the question, can I ask you once more? What if you never knew things that you needed to know? What if you never been places you needed to go? What if you get there and learn them as you go? What if, is the question, can I ask you once more? What if?
Cedric Muhammad. Cedric Muhammad.
June 17, 2009, Cedric Muhammad Black Coffee Program, blackelectorate.com, cedricmuhammad.com, blackcoffeechannel.com. A few stories I want to get into, but one thing I want to constantly update you all on, and I get into this on my book, securitization, the process by which loans are made or originated primarily so that they can be resold, is what it is most commonly referred to by me in terms of this current crisis. But securitization means any ownership claim that's based upon a revenue stream or something underlying, something underneath your ownership claim. So in the case of David Bowie, he secured what was underneath a Bowie bond was the revenue from his first 25 albums. He sold ownership claims on them in advance and was able to raise, I think, $50 million. So I could securitize account receivables. If somebody owes me payments, I can securitize loans. I can make a security out of anything. Well, finally, 6 months after the fact, the current administration is finally getting around. It says here the U.S. Treasury, from the Financial Times on yesterday, U.S. Treasury is planning a sweeping overhaul of securitization markets with tough new rules designed to restore confidence by reducing the incentive for lenders to originate bad loans and flip them on to investors. So again, we talked about this. I blogged about this in something called Securitization as Satan at CedricMuhammad.com if you want to learn more about this. People were bundling 1,000, 2,000, 300 mortgage, 3,000 mortgages that were put together, given to folks that didn't deserve it, couldn't pay the principal on the mortgage. And then this stuff was resold to people on Wall Street and then traded around and spread like a virus. According to the Financial Times, the authorities plan to force lenders to retain part of the credit risk of the loans that are bundled into securities and to end the gain on sale accounting rules that helped spur the boom of the markets at the heart of the financial crisis. The aim is to revitalize the markets for securities backed by mortgages and other assets without recreating the systemic risks that turned boom to bust in 2007. The plan is part of a wider overhaul of regulation unveiled today by President Obama. He just did some of that. Now, again, I've said this before, over 40 to 50% of the loans out there were being made because of securitization. You were only getting a loan because somebody knew that they could resell it to someone on Wall Street. So now the Treasury reforms are aimed at bringing some discipline to that market so that if I have a mortgage loan that I originate, I can't just sell that to somebody else. I have to keep part of that loan on my own books. I have to keep ownership of it so that I have an interest that will force me to be accountable. And it will also supposedly cause me to be more responsible in creating or in originating a loan. So I wouldn't give somebody a loan if I know I'm going to be stuck with some of it. You follow me? That's the logic behind it. In more business news that's relevant to you, Reebok's big ambition to leap past Puma. What did Jay-Z say? I took her from a a Reebok Bandit to Chanel sandals, something like that. Somebody give me the hot line from Jigga. Reebok aims to overtake Puma as the world's third largest sporting goods brand in the next 5 years, but it is facing a tough battle to rebuild its former high-quality image. After years in which the brand name was tarnished by its running shoes being sold cheaply alongside steaks and beer in supermarkets, Reebok's owner Adidas last year started the largest overhaul in the U.S. company's history. So right there, that's a lesson. Reebok diminished from its brand and its price started to communicate something that it didn't want to. When you could buy something by steaks in a supermarket by beer, that is not going to be a hot item you want. So Reebok trying to repair their image. They are owned by Adidas. After heavy investments in product management, design, and development, and streamlining sales and marketing efforts, Adidas hopes to revive Reebok to its former glory. But the restructuring has become an uphill struggle after a sharp fall in demand as a result of the global financial crisis. In the first quarter, Reebok reported an operating loss of $135 million. Okay, Reebok, big ambition. They got a map here of where Reebok sells the most. It sells most of its sales are in North America, then Europe, then Asia, and then Latin America. Okay? Now, there's another story in today's Financial Times called Securitization Reform Aims to Force Banks to Shoulder Greater Risk. This will just amplify the point I've been making. And again, this is important because if you're an entrepreneur, person going to school, person with credit cards, you're trying to figure out why it is you're not getting a loan anymore or credited easily. It's because the securitization market has dried up. There's no one for people to resell the loan that a person is going to make to you. There's no one or no market, no one on Wall Street who's willing to buy your credit card debt or your student loan or your small business loan. So the people are not originating it. Banks are not going to originate it if they can't resell it. This article says a large part of the U.S. consumer debt in the past decade, such as mortgages and cards, and credit card and student loans, has been financed by the sale of securities backed by such loans. A large chunk of business profits also came from this market as they bundled loans into securities and sold them to investors. The proposed rules from the U.S. Treasury aimed at making the securitized debt market safer crystallized what had already been a radical shift in investors' perceptions of securities backed by loans and in the bank's business models. The idea behind securitization is the assets, the loans, are able to back a bond. This means that the bonds rely on the credit worthiness of those loans rather than on the credit standing of the bank that made the loans in the first place. So it's all based upon you. And if people want to give you garbage and then repackage a claim of ownership on the garbage they gave you to others, you will have a systemic problem. Okay, I have a comment here. The great Cameron from Paterson, New Jersey, I think. I don't know. He's from Jersey. He, hold on. Let me put this symbol up. The symbol of excellence. The Caucasian sniper that the Philadelphia 76ers obtained. That man right there, Jason Capano. The future of the 76ers rides on the shoulders, the fingertips of a Caucasian. We just got, and I've been saying this for 2 years, I do not want any black people shooting three-pointers for me. I need a white man who can shoot it in from deep, long-range sniping. We had Kyle Korver. We gave him away to Utah. I was hoping that the 76ers could get Kyle Korver back. But we have Jason Capano. This man is the truth, in my view. If you beg to differ, if you're in Toronto, this is where he played before he came to Philly. Let me know. I hear nothing but good things. We sent out the footage on YouTube. This man made 24 out of 25 three-pointers. We know he doesn't play defense. No white three-point shooter plays any defense ever. And we know he probably can't create his own shot, but that's okay. We got Iguodala. Anyway, Cameron says, what upset? I just got the chance to comment. I admire your belief in the 76ers, but you have to be dreaming if you think a shooter is going to solve some of their problems. I'm laughing out loud at you. On the Stallworth issue, everyone is for his preferential treatment until it involves, or unless it involves, their daughter, sister, or themselves. Very organically stated, my brother. Yeah. Dante Stallworth got preferential treatment, and you know that. He got preferential treatment. Now let me warm this up a little bit. Big meeting in Moscow, the BRIC. Brazil, Russia, India, China linking up. President Ahmadinejad even was able to slip through from Iran. This is a powerful alliance coming together with the potential to rival U.S. dominance on economic matters. But how thoroughly are they united? Listen up.
Well, now, hot on the heels of Tuesday's BRIC summit, RT has caught up with Brazil's foreign minister to find out more about the aims of the bloc and how the four emerging economies plan to tackle the economic turmoil. That's coming your way next here on RT.
This is the first fully-fledged meeting of BRIC countries' leaders, but so far BRIC has been seen as perhaps little more than a joint interest club. Can Brazil, Russia, India and China form a fully-fledged economic union, or perhaps even increase their joint political clout?
Well, I think we are, this is a gradual process. I think it's the beginning, certainly, more a group for consultation and for coordination of political positions. But I think, since you said, as you said, we are a common interest group, so there may be many things in common that we can explore further on in terms of cooperation in economic sphere, finding new financial mechanisms to deal with our own questions, maybe cooperating in areas like science and technology, agriculture, energy. So I think the fact that we have this first summit, but it comes after already some ministerial meetings, foreign ministers meetings, and economic sector ministers, I think it's a good indication of the political will to give, let us say, flesh and bone to this group.
Well, you've already mentioned some of them, but what are the key areas of existing and future cooperation among BRIC countries, and where do their interests diverge?
Well, I would first try to look to where they converge, and I think we, the interests of the four countries converge above all in the changing of the structure of the world governance. Although we have different situations because, of course, Russia and China, for instance, are members of the Security Council, permanent members, and India and Brazil are not. In other areas, like in the financial institutions, we are all more or less on the same boat in terms of having the G20 more active. Although, again, Russia is a member of the G8, but it was not a member of the original G7, which economically and financially continued to have some role. So I think that there we will also have to coordinate positions. The fact that we are four big emerging markets and emerging economies also have make from a lot of commonality. And I would say that in other areas, like for instance the WTO, to which Russia is still acceding, then Brazil and India have been more active and more influential, even than China so far. I suppose China now will become because of the volume of its trade, but Russia is still exceeding. So, you know, the situations may be asymmetrical in a way, but I think that the fact that we have similar structures or similar structural positions in the world economy and the world politics make for a lot of cooperation. I would stress these convergences rather than very occasional differences.
Tackling the global financial crisis is one of the key issues at this summit. In what ways can BRIC countries cooperate to work their way out of the downturn?
First, I think, as most economists even recognize nowadays, that the BRIC are the four countries, the BRICS, or however you call them, they are part of the solution for the crisis. They are the economies that are more likely to have a big growth, and these will help the world economy as a whole.
Okay, I'm going to put a pause on that. We'll get back to that in its entirety. This is a big deal to me, the BRIC. Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Could this be a possible rival to the United States of America. Any further delay, let me bring on our resident guru on these such things. Glenn from Philly is in the building.
How's it going, Seth?
Good, brother. Hey, Glenn, it was you. I was trying to figure out who I was speaking to. You may not have noticed that you and I were building a couple times, but I used a word called, how could you say? I wrote it down. Hold on, brother. Preciseness. Do you remember that? I actually I used the word preciseness. I found out where it came from. But what's good, brother? What's securitization now? They trying to regulate it. We got Brazil, Russia, India, China talking kind of real aggressively toward the U.S., man. What's your assessment right now of the markets in general?
Right. Well, right now, like as you said, like the word of the day is regulation. The Obama administration, for the most part, they look like they're attempting to modernize our current regulatory environment. I heard part of his speech today, and he made direct reference to 20th century regulations, trying to deal with 21st century speed within the financial markets. So they attack directly or try to take on securitization, whereas, like I believe you stated before I came on it, I think 5% of securitized loans have to be kept in-house, which is to prevent these banks from doing like a quick origination and then distribution of the particular loan.
So can we say that this is the end of the ninja loan? No documentation, no income, no assets?
I think so. I think absolutely. I think so. There will be probably an unintended consequence to that. There's going to be, like I said, there's going to be 5% of the securitized loans have to be held in, as well as there's going to be tougher capital requirements. I think the unintended consequence will be like an increase in lending standards, absolutely, which will potentially lead to a reduction in the availability of credit. And I think that speaks directly to something that I know you talk about a lot, because I think it'll transition over into to business loans as well as, you know, regular mortgage and consumer credit.
Now, don't you think, how do you think the smaller community banks will fare with these additional capital requirements? Does it matter at all, you think?
I tend to think that they seem to be a little bit sometimes better operationally. So I have a little bit of faith in their ability to adapt to what's going to happen. But by the same token, the ones that don't, you'll probably wind up seeing some increased consolidation.
Right, they'll just get took over, yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think about this BRIC meeting, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and then even Ahmadinejad snuck in the building for a minute for a photo op? Is this real? Do you think that these countries are serious about moving away from the dollar? Are they conflicted, confused? Is this a united front in appearance only, or are they behind the doors really talking about a future where America is a not the dominant economic power?
I think they want to, as any individual or group of individuals wants to move forward or move up in rank as they start to see that they're starting to gain some economic power. I don't necessarily know if it's going to happen right away, but I wouldn't be surprised if they're definitely talking along the lines of their currency definitely being stronger and not necessarily the dollar being the global reserve currency, you know, in perpetuity. And, you know, there's been like a number of countries, I think Russia being one of them, China, of course, who talked about the U.S. dollar. By the same token, they still hold a lot of our treasury. And the reason for that in large measure is because there's not really much else out there. There's no other real place to go for them as of yet. But when you look at, you know, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, you look at them kind of like the young guns, so to speak, on the block economically, who are coming up and are seeing increased investment within their country. And if they, you know, coming together, I would not be surprised at all if they want to challenge, you know, the U.S. status as the main economic power globally.
Now, on the market level, commodities, currencies, bonds, and stocks, what's looking good?
Market level today, just in general stock market, the market is up today, which actually surprised me. But when I took a little bit of a further look at it, the financials, I believe, are down today. Financials are down, as well as energy is down. But healthcare and consumer, I believe consumer discretionary, are doing good, which kind of or consumer staples, I believe, are doing well, which to me kind of signals a flight of quality to a certain extent. On the commodity front, I think the dollar strengthened a little bit recently. So you've seen gas prices, although it's not going to translate to the pump. Gasoline, at least yesterday, was down a little bit. By the same token, inventory data came out today. I think gasoline supplies were higher than expected. But there's kind of like a pull and tug between what I've heard is an oversupply of oil on the market, but there's been such an increased monetization on our end from like just the U.S. Treasury and printing dollars that anytime you have that happen, you're going to see the tendency for investors to rush to quality on the commodity end as well. So that's why you've seen like a lot of the gas prices and the oil prices previously, but then I guess like the past couple months or so, increase significantly, even though there's supposed to be a glut of supply.
So how can folks get in touch with you? They want some, learn a little bit more and build with you further.
Sure. Just anyone can send me an email. The best way to reach me by email is Glenn at GlennWilliamsJr.com. And, you know, any questions that anyone may have or just discussing economics or financial markets in general, I'll be happy to talk with people about that.
Okay, enough of that. Let's talk about the real news. Jason Capano, 76ers, brother.
Yeah.
Is this it?
I know you got the one you wanted.
Brother, I got a white man shooting my three-pointers again. Oh, man.
Yeah, well, I'm waiting to see what they pick up in the draft. I know they're probably looking at, I would think they'd be looking at a point guard, just in case Andre Miller goes someplace else.
Glenn, did you see the footage of our brother Jason? Shooting
brother Jason
24 out of 25 three-pointers. That white man is now brother Jason.
Yeah, he can definitely hit from the outside. I mean, he's got a nice shot, and they need that, among other things, you know, the Sixers need. And I'm hoping that they don't fall into this glut of consistently being like the sixth or seventh seed in the playoffs.
Well,
and then getting bounced out.
You know, New Jersey Net fan or Brooklyn Net soon-to-be fan or New York Knicks fan that he probably is, Cam from Paterson, New Jersey. Listen to this hate. He sent in a comment. He says, "Said you're going to have those cats in Philly fighting all over the ball." He says, "A shooter loves to get the ball, so the point guard is going to be looking for him coming down the floor and ignore the dunking machine or Elton Brand." You know who the dunking machine is. He's taking a shot at our man.
Yeah.
Who still can't hit a three regularly, Andre Iguodala.
Yeah, no.
He says, hopefully they can pass the ball well and work like Sacramento did with Chris Webber, Jason Williams, Bibby, Divac, and their two shooters, Turkoglu and Stojakovic.
Oh.
Damn, I forgot Turkoglu and Stojakovic. Were they at the same time?
I think so, yeah. Ooh, they were.
Ooh, man.
Yeah. Turkoglu, yeah, good, yeah, he had
oh,
a good
man.
Playoff.
Turkoglu was the man. I wish I had some money for him. I had two white men shooting three-pointers.
Yeah. Have you heard the talk about, I'm sorry, you going to say something?
No, go ahead.
Yeah, have you heard the talk? I mean, I've heard a lot of talk about your man Kobe, people trying to put him in the top five echelon.
What, top five ever?
Time. Yeah.
Nah.
I'm not ready to do it.
Nah.
I think he's close, but I'm not ready.
Well, do you have a top five?
I do, actually.
Go ahead, run it down. Glenn from Philly.
I would go with Michael Jordan. I go with Will Chamberlain. I go with Magic Johnson. And as much as it pains me to do so, I have two Boston Celtics in my top five. That's Bill Russell and Larry Bird.
Well, you know, Star from Stormbug Wild calls Larry Bird the greatest player of all time.
Yeah,
I saw that. You saw that, yeah. Brother, how did, you got Magic in there?
I do, because he shot 50%.
Did he?
Yeah, I think so. And it was like 19-11 and 7, I think he did over his career.
Yeah, Magic is a great one. I'm gonna have to work on my top five. Kobe is definitely not in there. I mean, if he gets like five or six, you know, but you know what? He has to go through Boston.
Mm-hmm.
You can't win your championship with Kevin Garnett is on the bench. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, I know what you mean.
One more time, Glenn, where everybody can get a hold of you.
Glenn at GlennWilliamsJr.com.
Family, this is a dangerous time of the day to talk to Glenn because he's in between trades. So we're going to let him go. But Glenn, I will build with you. We'll figure out a way to motivate folks to do for self one way or the other.
Absolutely. And speaking to that matter, the issue of the securitization or the tightening on that is going to impact people directly in regards to what you're saying in terms of doing for self, because that'll impact commercial credit as well. So.
Oh, you have it from one who is credentialized to drop knowledge. He just don't have it. He's credentialized to drop knowledge. All right, brother.
All right, thanks a lot. Sir.
Talk to you soon. I want you to know a white man was up during half your interview. Jason Capano,
okay,
brother.
No problem.
All right. Peace,
all right.
Man. Glenn from Philly, y'all. That's right. He's a 76ers fan. Markets guru. We're not tolerating no negative talk from Cameron from New Jersey, who's probably thinking that LeBron is going to come to Brooklyn or something. We'll get back with him later. Let me get back to this brick discussion. We interrupted that to give you some light from Glenn from Philly. This is the foreign minister of Brazil being interviewed on Russia Today TV yesterday.
You can help by growing, taking the right measures, as for instance China is taking with a lot of attention in the internal market. Brazil is also taking because we had, in a way, we had a anti-cyclical program even before the crisis started because of our needs to develop and to grow. A country like Russia, you look around, you see there's so much need to for growth, new buildings, new roads, new dams. So all these are anti-cyclical and they will help the economy. In many ways also, we can come with new ideas. I mean, the fact that we were not involved in the creation of this financial crisis with the subprime derivatives and so on, we have economies that rely more on the real activity of people. So cooperation also comes by means of ideas.
Brazil has recently criticized the developed economy's response to the crisis, saying that rescuing failing financial institutions and pouring more money into the global economy is shallow. What do you think is the right response?
Well, the right response would be to help. We're not against, of course, helping the economy, provided you help the real economy, which makes for real growth, and at the same time don't create protectionist barriers. On the other hand, you could put more money in the areas, for instance, like finance for trade, and especially for trade among developing countries and even poorer countries, not speaking of the BRIC necessarily, but speaking of African countries, of other poor countries in Asia and Latin America who suffered so much from the crisis. For instance, in the case of Brazil, the whole of South America is very important for us, and our trade with South America got down very much because there was a fall in demand in these countries. So if the big developed markets are more open, if subsidies are eliminated, as we hope in the WTO, all these will create more avenues for trade, for growth, and for recovery. I think we need more regulation, not only at national level, but at international level. And for these, also the participation of countries like the BRIC is very important.
Now, a lot has been said about BRIC countries wanting to reduce their dependence on the dollar. Do you support the idea?
Well, I think this is something necessary, but this will have to be something gradual. It's not as if you could abolish the dollar from one day to the other. Maybe you don't want even to abolish the dollar ever. Totally, but I think if we can, for instance, give more importance to the special drawing rights, SDRs, of the IMF, this can be an embryo of an international currency. But this will take time. I don't think it's something that will happen now, immediate. Another thing that can be done, and that we, for instance, are doing with Argentina, it's easy to do in a regional context, but it's not impossible to do, is to use more the national currencies for our own trade. We don't need the reference of the dollar. So we have also to create financial mechanisms that will help us to face situations like that. It's not only the currency, but also the presence of other financial mechanisms.
Foreign Minister of Brazil dropping knowledge on Russia TV. Now let me get into this model. Least developed country economic model that pretty much the whole world has had to embrace post-colonial, post-imperialist era. This was a big subject on my introduction for my proposal to the African Union, because I wanted to lay a framework acknowledging the reality that really every African government is dealing with. So you tell me whether you agree that this fits at least 80% accurately the picture of the reality of countries in Asia, Central South America, Africa, and I think if you don't accept that there's been kind of like a cut and paste approach to economic development for countries all over the world coming out of the colonial era, you kind of, I think, are at a loss to explain why countries can't get out of the mess that they're in. And this comes from conversations that I had directly with a retired Lieutenant Colonel in the Air Force liaison to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the CIA, Fletcher Prouty. We've talked about him in the past. Some of this is in the book JFK that he wrote. And then some additional conversations and research that I added to refine this. So here we go. This is actually from my Africa Union proposal, which I intend to turn into a book before the year's out, that will deal with how to establish the United States of Africa, not just through a single currency, but through a new development economy. So I've been building with some people, very intelligent. One individual, Mark Milley, Double M, adding on to the cipher and expanding my worldview on this subject. Now, the quote in my, that I started my African Union proposal on, which you'll see whenever I publish this thing, or put the book out, is a quote from Julius Nyerere, the president of Tanzania. And also, my friends in Tanzania, tell me his middle name. I had to adjust this in my paper. Julius Nyerere, in the top quote, I say, he says, "We are neither poor nor are we kept poor because we are black. We remain poor because of the world trading and monetary systems, and these, whatever their other disadvantages, are colorblind." He said that in June 1974 at the University of Dar es Salaam, first president of Tanzania. Kwame Nkrumah stated, "Ghana inherited a colonial economy, and we cannot rest until we have demolished this miserable structure and raised in its place an edifice of economic stability, thus creating for ourselves a veritable paradise of abundance and satisfaction." What is a colonial economy? It's the question that I ask. I mean, really think about it. If you're a country coming out of colonialism, what are you working with? I go on to say, it is one where a country is independent in name, but whose financial and business activities are ideologically, structurally, or institutionally dictated by unwelcome external forces. By this definition, the independence movement has yet to fully deliver what Nkrumah envisioned, with aspects of the colonial economy continuing in virtually every part of Africa labeled as developing or least developed. Now, I'm making an assertion there. I'm saying that the colonial economy continues. Now, some people may not want to hear that in Africa, even. But that is a fact. Let me go on. Such labels obscure basic facts regarding the nature of what is loosely collectively called third world nation collectively, or a less developed country, LDCs, or less advanced country, LAC. While LDCs are considered sovereign equals in places like the United Nations, where one state, one vote guides affairs, such a naive view of equality does not apply to the economic reality for Africa. The true definition of least developed or less developed has nothing to do with politics, ideology, or military power. An LDC is a country that does not have the ability to produce all of the things it needs to survive, even at a relatively low level of subsistence. Of course, self-sufficiency does not always equate to autarky. A country can be considered self-sufficient if it can get what it needs in terms of trade rather than relying on aid. Paradoxically, traditional village life is above all self-sufficient, while Western urbanization is not. Villagers have solved the problems of the necessities, food, clothing, and shelter on a modest scale, without the assistance of lawyers, bankers, or state politics, although many have central governments. And they are not dependent upon airplanes, trains, trucks, or automobiles for their daily bread. LDCs do not have the carrying capacity for bare existence and real growth in modern terms. Therefore, they must be aided. Now, all this discussion recently about ending aid dependency in Africa, I'm dealing with it as part of the least developed country economy or the colonial economy. That's by design that you're depending upon aid. Here's why. As a result, the biggest businesses in less developed countries and a primary reason for its governmental power structure is import and export. So the governmental structure of a least developed country that depends on foreign aid, everything revolves around the import and export economy. That's what government is actually built around. LDCs aim to export enough to make payments on the interest on their national debt with enough left over to pay for what they must import. Now, this is me again, parenthetically. And remember now, oil is denominated in dollars. So we talked about the problems in Cuba with rationing. Cuba needs foreign exchange currency. That's why they like tourism. That's why the dollar is used in these countries that hate America. They need it to purchase certain machinery, oil, certain capital goods that they can't get in their own currency or others. The government of such a country is a business monopoly over its people, and its territory motivated less by some political ideology than by pragmatic control of the import-export business. I mean, listen carefully. I'm saying that government essentially is not communist, socialist, free market, conservative, left, right, center. A government is a business monopoly. That's what it is. It has a monopoly over who can trade, when, where, and what. That's a business monopoly. Again, the government of such a country is a business monopoly over its people and its territory, motivated less by some political ideology than by pragmatic control of the import-export business. In most LDCs, customs activity and border patrol are the most important elements of government, enabling political leadership to maintain its monopoly and an accurate and essential account of everything exported and imported by the country. If you control the border patrol and the customs activity, you control a country's economy in these types of nations. I'm going to say that again. If you control customs and border patrol in what is called a least developed country, you control everything, because the nature of the economy is dependent on export and import. LDC governments. Now, you put any country I'm saying here. I don't care if it's Cuba, Zimbabwe, Angola, Indonesia. When I say LDC government, you just pick any country you want from those parts of the world. LDC governments make money granting exclusive and monopolistic franchises to their friends, relatives, and true financial and traditional leaders of national infrastructure. For everything from chewing gum to fighter jets. These franchise holders are called the INS. They're in power. These franchise holders, the INS, are usually assured of becoming millionaires. Their franchisees are obtained through contacts with select sources in countries and powers abroad. Now, this is the power of the trader. The most, when you look at how we got into slavery and how colonialism was maintained, it was through the work of a trader. This is the trader is the person operating inside of a country who gets their franchisee power in a certain industry from the government, and they obtain it and maintain it through contact with select sources in other countries and powers abroad. So the Indians were like this in parts of East Africa. Now there's some good. There is some good that the trader can do, because the trader introduces you to information and novelties and goods and services that are from other parts of the world. They're also able to help you with financial transactions. Trader, the merchant, that's a real big position in an economy. It can be used to oppress people, and it can be used to eventually develop an economy beyond a subsistence level. Now, if you look at some of the farmers in Africa that have to move product from far into urban areas, they will have a trader or maybe one person who's good at moving things to market, setting prices, bringing in imports. So that person becomes a very vital element of the eventual development of the community and the economy if they are not exploiting the people. Okay, more on that later. Again, these franchise holders are the ends, and they are usually assured of becoming millionaires. And these are people close to the government. Their franchisees are obtained through contracts and contacts with select sources in countries and powers abroad. They cover all the essentials required by the populace. There is no other way to obtain foreign-produced goods, including foodstuffs, which must be imported. The same franchise system applies to exports. Now, I just explained the role of the trader, their relationship with the government, and their connection to the outside world. They are the link. These franchise holders, these traders, T-R-A-D-E-R, they are the ones who obtain foreign-produced goods that are required by the people that must be imported. The same franchise system applies to exports. The outs, those who are not in power. So I used the phrase in the ends earlier, okay? So now I'm talking about the outs. The outs are those who have been stripped of their franchisees, usually as a result of a coup d'etat in favor of the ruling group. So when you see a country having a coup, and you got people moving in and out of power, what they're really getting control of is the business monopoly of a government. Favored trading, positioning, and exclusive franchisee, the exclusive right to sell something. Okay? So now we're talking about the outs. The outs are those who have been stripped of their franchisees, usually as a result of a coup d'etat in favor of the ruling group. The term political party and the words communism, socialism, free market, and democracy rarely apply easily. This is why I'm begging you all, just get away from political ideology. You are caught up on terminology that can't explain the business monopoly. You got people on the left that come into power. Well, they're taking control of the franchise rights of an economy as well. They have the exclusive right to do trade here. It doesn't matter whether they're communist or conservative or left or right, socialist, Islamic, fundamentalists. They're all trying to control the same thing, the business monopoly of a government, the right to decide who gets what, when, where, and how. Again, the term political party and the words communism, socialism, free market, and democracy rarely apply easily. The outs are definitely on the outside looking in, and they represent an ever-present danger to the ends through the possibility of a coup d'etat. In most LDCs, there are no meaningful campaigns and elections. The votes, if elections are held, are counted by the armed forces, an instrument of the in power group, and such controls leave the outs little alternative but coup for power transition. So the CIA and the intelligence agencies, they only deal in terms of ins and outs. They will work with you if you are Muslim. They'll work with you if you are free market, liberal Democrat. They'll work with you if you are a communist. But they mainly work through the military, because it's through the military that they're able to bolster the image and the leadership profile of someone and provide resources. So that's why you'll find a lot of the leaders in Asia, Africa, Central, South America, they come up from the army. Well, the United States and foreign countries develop these leaders through military assistance programs, MAPs, and you'll find that some young colonel or some young lieutenant will emerge out of the army in Pakistan or the Philippines. It's the same story. Even in the Congo, you'll see this. All of a sudden, a guy will pop up. These rebel groups will pop up. They'll have new equipment, shiny, crisp uniforms. Where do they get the money from? You got to think about this. The people are not necessarily supporting these groups. The people will come and support somebody after they pop up. So if I'm in the United States and I want to change the rulership of somebody in Sudan, I can back rebel groups in some obscure part of the country, Darfur, give them new equipment. And the people who are suffering in that area, they don't know why all of a sudden somebody in the military is able to provide transportation, goods and services, and even money to the populace. This is how the CIA took over the Philippines and Thailand. The Philippines and Vietnam. They created and backed leaders through the military assistance program, Saigon Mission. Look into that. So in all LDCs, the difference between the ins and outs has little, if anything, to do with political ideology. The scenario depicted by the major powers divides the world into socialist and West camps, and more recently, or increasingly, Islamic fundamentalism and the West. Often power centers external to the LDC keep the books and the balances of the ins and outs, making the transactions of the government's business monopoly possible by offering loans, providing aid, issuing letters of credit, collecting huge fees for their role in each transaction, and collecting the interest on the entire package. In many LDCs, the total amount of interest paid to this external international financing structure, made up of other governments, multilateral institutions, and private concerns, often amounts to more than half of the total value of export revenues. For this reason, annual payments are often only on the interest involved and not on the principal. This narrative of the LDC has been the story of countries throughout the African continent. And I could say the same for Asia, Central South America. Okay? So it is always a war to control this business monopoly, the customs and the border patrol, the exclusive monopoly rights to trade in certain products, whether it's beverages, gum, fighter jets, and then the ability to get foreign exchange. That's what these governments are constantly on a treadmill going to nowhere over. Okay, now that I've said that, let me read what's going on in South Africa. Maybe this will give you a little bit of context. It says here, crisis forces South Africa to trim agenda. South African President Jacob Zuma said the nation's recession, its first in 17 years, would likely force the government to adjust the massive public development agenda that bolstered his popular appeal and helped propel him to office. "We're going to cut the cloth according to our size," Mr. Zuma said in an interview here on the sidelines of the World Economic Forum for Africa. This was June 13th and 14th, Wall Street Journal. "In other words, the implementation of our commitments is not going to be like it was when there was no economic crisis. South Africa, the largest economy in sub-Saharan Africa, likely fell into recession earlier this year. That is due largely to falling prices for platinum and diamonds, as well as slackening demand for manufactured exports." Okay, so now you can see the export market. And again, if you look at a country, you want to know who has the power, is usually those folks who sell exports, products abroad, mining, farming. Those types of companies are the ones who have the most influence, and they're the ones that the government will most likely develop economic policy. The reason why you don't have developed economies where you have the division of labor, all kinds of different domestic producers and entrepreneurs and all kinds of industries outside of mining and farming, is because those are the industries that bring in foreign exchange, which is needed for a country to buy its imports. So now that the export market for countries in Africa, Asia, Central, South America is drying up, all of these countries are saying the same tune. They're singing the same tune, whether it's Chavez in Venezuela, whether it's Raul Castro in Cuba, Jacob Zuma in South Africa, Joseph Kabila in Congo. It's the same thing they're saying. "Despite the downturn, South Africa has moved forward with a 787 billion rand, about $98 billion infrastructure spending program. The investment binge is focused on roads and electricity. Mr. Zuma said he expects that investment to generate jobs that stimulate the economy. In late 2007, Mr. Zuma defeated former President Thabo Mbeki in a leadership race for the ruling African National Congress. That victory paved the way for his election as president earlier this year. In both races, he promised to help narrow the wealth gap in the country, a growing problem that would require major investment in poverty reduction. But there's no money for that. That's why sometimes I offend people because I say elections are meaningless and people misunderstand what I'm saying. You can campaign all you want on how you're going to lift up the poor, but when you get in the seat of power, you're looking at the business monopoly. You're trying to bleed a rock, trying to get money from mining and farming. In the case of South Africa, they're trying to sell platinum and diamonds when demand for these goods is a slack. What are you going to do now that you don't have the money coming in from abroad? You have a budget shortfall. You got to pick and choose. Mr. Zuma declined to offer specifics Friday about what changes he might make to his party's plan for addressing domestic woes such as high unemployment, crumbling infrastructure, scant affordable housing, and poor public education and health care. He said those decisions would have to be made by the ministries responsible. If I were to give the details now, I'd actually be doing the job of the government departments, he said. Still, Mr. Zuma said that a meeting between the directors general or permanent secretaries in his new cabinet had concluded that despite the downturn, most of the government's plans would be able to proceed. Let me read an article from Venezuela. This is from Mary Anastasia O'Grady, anti-Castro, anti-Chavez, anti-Evo Morales, anti-Ortega. But listen to what she's saying. She has a column in the Wall Street Journal, June 1st, 2009. It's called Chavez's Cash Crunch. Here's another reason to worry about recent signs that the U.S. dollar is again heading south. A slumping dollar could grant much-needed relief to Yankee beta Hugo Chavez, whose presidency is beginning to buckle from a shortage of the greenbacks he needs to pay for imports and to keep the national oil monopoly running. Even the Venezuelan despot is panicking. Last month, he accelerated his crackdown on freedom. But far from being a sign of strength, the steps he took were desperate measures designed to stave off an economic debacle. At issue is the dollar price of oil, Venezuela's dominant source of hard currency. The bubble generated by a loose U.S. monetary policy in the early part of this decade reversed a period of historically low oil prices in the late 1990s and gifted Mr. Chavez with a windfall in oil revenue for most of his 10 years in office. But an oil economy is a double-edged sword, and in the past year, the Castro wannabe has become more vulnerable. A stronger dollar and reduced demand for crude has meant fewer dollars flowing into Venezuela. Add in what industry analysts say is a significant drop in output due to the politicization of the oil monopoly known as PDVSA, and it's easy to see why central bank reserves have been shrinking. See, the central bank has been stacking dollars because they need them to buy imports and they want to protect themselves from a rainy day. It's the same economy, family. It's what I'm saying. You can go to Venezuela. You can go to Angola. I could put a, what do you call that, a dart at a map and throw it. Now, don't get me wrong. There are nuances, but they're all dealing with the same thing. They have to sell things abroad that they dig up from the ground, and the people in power have to give franchise rights to their friends, their supporters, in order to reward them for getting them elected. Otherwise, you're dealing with a coup. So whether it's democracy or a coup, it's all over the same thing. Who gets the right to control the government business monopoly?
Showboy, stimulating and hot. It's the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee program.
These are not just academic exercises. We're not analyzing the media on Mars or in the 18th century or something like that. We're dealing with real human beings who are suffering and dying and being tortured and starving because of policies that we are involved in. We as citizens of democratic societies are directly involved in and are responsible for. And what the media are doing is ensuring that we do not act on our responsibilities, and that the interests of power are served, not the needs of the suffering people, and not even the needs of the American people, who would be horrified if they realized the blood that's dripping from their hands because of the way they're allowing themselves to be deluded and manipulated by the system.